Welcome to the Mindful Sobriety Podcast with your hosts, Jane and Amanda. I'm Jane, a licensed psychotherapist and alcohol-free retreat host.
And I'm Amanda, alcohol-free lifestyle coach and yoga instructor. We're so glad you're here. Today we have Rory Kinsella on the podcast. Rory is a Vedic meditation teacher and a sober coach based in Sydney, Australia. A former hard-drinking musician and journalist, he quit alcohol in 2017 and now helps others change their relationship with alcohol through his Wise Monkey Way online programs. He teaches an effortless style of meditation using a mantra that allows the mind to move beyond thoughts to a place of stillness within.
Today we have Rory on the podcast. Rory, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. It's great to be here.
We are so excited just to hear a little bit about your story and pick your brain on kind of how you have approached sobriety and meditation and that sort of thing. So we're just super pumped to get to talk to you today.
Yeah, well, me too. So, I mean, we can start with my story. So as we were saying before we press record, I'm originally from England, but I live in Australia, and they're both very drink heavy countries.
Yes. Which one do you think is more drink heavy? I think of England as being more drink heavy, but I don't know for sure. So,
yeah, well, I would say that it is. I mean, they're both, Australia is a funny place because it's kind of a 50-50 mix of English and American culture. Yeah. So it's got this weird thing where it's like English pub culture and then California surf culture and this kind of middle ground. But I think England's got more of a drinking culture. Aussies love their beers, and I think they have their barbecues and their beers, and it's more of a regular thing. But I think England definitely has more of the heavy drinker culture, and that's what I grew up with. So in the 90s.
The dreary, dark at 4 p.m. what else are we going to do culture?
Well, yeah, exactly. And it's common. Well, it was my experience growing up is that we would start drinking quite early in our teens. So I remember being at friends' 12th birthday parties and people sneaking booze in, and I think I was first sick from drinking when I was 12. And then that wasn't every week, but at maybe 14, 15, it was getting more regular, and it's very common in England, or it was in the 90s, for people to go to the pub at 15, 16, and it would be socially acceptable because you get picked up by your parents. And I remember Mum would say things like, "Have you been smoking?" And I'd be like, "No, it's just very smoky in there." But being a natural introvert, I really enjoyed what alcohol did for me early on, in that it made me more extrovert. And I thought, this is great. You know, this is a way to be able to be more of that extrovert person and do stupid things and talk to girls and those things that I felt I couldn't do. So I thought,
totally
alcohol,
relate to that. It's like this magic potion.
Yeah. So I thought, this is brilliant. Like, why didn't people tell me about this before? I can see why this is so popular. And really just lived that life from, you know, regularly going to the pub at 15, 16 through to university, which I'm sure it's like it is in the States. It's like a boarding school, but with a cheap bar. I remember it used to be £1 a pint was the thing that they had in the bar. So it was, drinking all through school. And, you know, I come from an academic family, so I did well at school. But I remember there would be a few school trips. Like, I did languages, so I did two French exchanges and got into trouble for being a drinking ringleader at 14. And then we went on a Russian exchange trip. So I also did Russian language. And again, I remember I got a written warning for the French trip, And then I came back again and got in trouble again for drinking. And they were like, right, this is your second final written warning. And I remember being this cheeky 16-year-old saying, you can't have two final written warnings. Surely final's final. And they were like, shut up.
So what part of England was this? Was this like around London or?
So this was in Bristol. So I grew up in Bristol, which is in the southwest. Okay. And in the 90s, yeah. Bristol was a real music hub. So you had bands like Massive Attack and Portishead and the drum and bass scene, which is amazing. So I loved growing up there. And then I went to university in Birmingham. So continued doing this drinking thing, which is very normal for English kids growing up. And then I remember at the end of uni, I had no plans and bumped into a friend of mine who was in a band. And I was like, congrats on getting your band signed to this record label. And they were like, yeah, it's all going really well, but we need a bass player. And I was like, oh, I'm a bass player. So there was my, I didn't need to get a job anymore. I was in this band. And then what do musicians do? They drink. So I was like, I've been doing all this practice.
Already like a rock star.
Yeah. So I've been practicing since 14 at my drinking. And that was really leading me to be in a band. But it was quite funny because it was actually the least rock and roll band you could imagine. Like half of them were evangelical Christians. And I was like pretending. I was pretending that it was this super rock and roll thing while they're all going to church on Sunday.
So were y'all singing like Christian type music, or was it more?
No, it wasn't. Secular? It wasn't Christian music. Yeah, it was all just normal kind of folky, rocky, funk. Sounds like a weird combination describing it. But folky, no, that they would just privately do their religious stuff, and I would privately do my rock star stuff. Yeah. So that. Then set the tone for my 20s. And then when I started working, I worked as a music journalist. And what do journalists do? They drink heavily.
Oh, goodness, yes.
And the more I work with people, though, the more I find out that, guess what, every industry is like, oh yeah, that's a big drinking industry. Oh, lawyers, yeah, big drinkers. Doctors, oof, they're the worst.
Yeah, healthcare workers.
Yeah, so I became a journalist and I moved to London. I worked for a TV station. And then for my job, I was interviewing musicians and going to gigs. And it was really this thing where it was so normalized that I never really questioned my drinking because everyone else was doing it. It was even, you know, it's funny if you came to work drunk or hungover or you were late. Yeah. I remember at my job in London, we had this thing called the hangover hat of shame, which is this big sombrero thing. That you had to wear if you were visibly or if you smelt like alcohol.
Oh my gosh.
So it was funny,
the booze,
right?
Is oozing from your pores.
Yeah. So I really enjoyed living that life, and I was still getting my benefit from it. So my benefit was I could be more extrovert and I could stop my overthinking mind because I've always been a bit of an overthinker. Mm-hmm. And it just helped me chill out. And I didn't really see many downsides because as many of us know, like hangovers don't really exist when you're younger.
They're definitely progressively, they get worse as you get older for sure.
Yeah. So then I continued living this life. And then at 31, me and an ex-girlfriend moved from London to Sydney. And I have a friend here who says, yeah, you Brits, you have your 20s in London and then you come to Sydney and then you have your 20s again in your 30s.
That sounds pretty nice.
Yeah, so I have my 20s again in my 30s in Sydney, still working as a journalist, but I was a lifestyle journalist. So I would get to review bars and restaurants, and I remember getting taken to a vodka festival in New Zealand for a week, which was just horrible thinking back.
Painful.
And going to Vegas for 4 days where it was you know, the most debauched time I can remember, but it was work, right? So then reaching this point when I was 35 on my 35th birthday, so as well as playing in bands, I was also a DJ and a club promoter and existing in all these seedy places, the seediest of which was this 35th birthday party that we organized, which is in this warehouse that we found out later was also used as a sex club. So they were like, don't bring any UV lights. You don't want to see what's on the furniture. And we had conversations with the owners about who would get the profits from the drug dealers. Like, it was super seedy. And I remember just thinking, I'm not enjoying this anymore. And I decided at that point that I was going to stop DJing, and I quit smoking. They were my first two things. And I was like, okay, I never even considered stopping drinking at that point. Mm-hmm. But I was like, this is a kind of round age where I want to start changing things. So at that point, I started running and trying to get fit and doing these psychology things, which a year after that was when I found meditation. But it was the running that was the thing that showed me that I could change my conscious state in a different way to ingesting.
A little bit of an altered state.
Yeah. You know, the runner's high, they call it. It's a real thing. Like, it's not as easily deliverable as booze and drugs, but you get it.
You get endorphins. A little bit for it. Yeah.
But you feel good. And what I noticed was, you sometimes get that full runner's high where you get tingles up the back of your neck. But really, the benefit I would get is I would feel better. Like, the next day I'd get natural endorphins and natural serotonin, which made me more positive. And that meant that when it got to the end of the week, I was less trying to escape the week. So my drinking was, I have been a daily drinker, and I had a couple of years where I drank every day, but I was mostly a weekend binger, a party animal. And I just found when I started exercising, I'd be less likely to do that, but was still doing it. But the real turning point for me came when I learned to meditate. And that just created this huge shift in me where I was suddenly felt comfortable in my skin. And because before I knew I wanted to drink less, but as soon as anyone would say, hey, do you want to go out? It's Wednesday. Let's go and get, I don't know, mojitos or something. I'd be like, okay, a part of me says I don't want to, but I had this people pleaser thing, which was like, oh, I should say yes. Or, you know,
if I don't say yes, maybe they won't ask me again. Or, you know, our mind comes up with all sorts of kind of scenarios that don't sound pleasant.
Oh, exactly. And then I learned to meditate. Well, I had this exploration where I tried a few different styles, but I found that the meditation style that I stuck with, which is Vedic meditation. And that week I just felt comfortable enough to say, hey, no, I'll come out with you on Wednesday, but I'm not having any mojitos. I'll have a sparkling water and I'll go home. And I did keep drinking. I moderated for the next 2 years. Mm-hmm. I found it much easier to strike a balance and not feel so needy for it. Like, so if we think back to how I was describing my teenage thing, whereas it was this great crutch, it was this great enabler of me feeling safe and secure and comfortable and able to be myself and be extrovert, I no longer needed that. And being myself was more being able to say no. So I was able to do that and feel not stressed. So it would get to the end of the work week and I wouldn't feel like there was this huge weight of stress weighing down on me because I was managing my stress. This is the other thing. I never thought of myself as a stressed person. I'm this chilled guy from Bristol. And I wouldn't be stressed at people, but I would be stressed on the inside. I would be
carrying it.
I'd be angry. I'd be angry at you, but you wouldn't know. But I would be saying horrible things.
You would appear very chill, but you're not on the inside.
Not on the inside. Yeah. So this is why it was strange for me to think, well, look, I was a stressed person. I just didn't realize it because
that a lot of people are like that. Like, I don't have stress or I don't have anxiety, but that's because their behavior would not indicate that they do, but they're carrying a lot and they're ruminating and they have things planned to a T. You know, there's other ways that people have these like safety behaviors integrated into their lives to cope that it just seems like, well, that's just what people do. So they assume they don't have stress.
Well, yeah. So part of my thing as a meditation teacher now is figuring out ways to let people know that they do have stress, even if they don't know about it. And even if maybe the doctor might be saying that your blood pressure is high, but the doctor might not be saying that. So it was only after I went, oh, I must have been so stressed. It was only through that contrast, because it's like, you know, the analogy of the frog in the boiling pot of water. It doesn't notice that it's about to boil until it boils. Yeah, it just doesn't notice. And it was like, after I learned to meditate, it was like taking off a pair of shoes which has been tied up too tight, and you just kind of accept it. But then you take them off and go, oh, this feels so nice. why was I doing that before? So that led to this period where I was much more comfortable not drinking. But it was, I then had a moderation period of 2 years until, because I didn't have any role models of, I didn't know anyone who didn't drink or who had given up, who wasn't like a rehab AA type person.
Mm-hmm. Like so a rock bottom type alcohol use disorder.
Yeah. So I just assume, well, this is just, I just need to go out less. Just need to see my friends less. And that will be my solution. Until I went on this meditation retreat in Mexico. This is when I was 40, and it was a proper midlife crisis moment. I was like, I'm single, I'm 40, it's New Year, I'm going to go to Mexico.
That's a long way from Australia.
So I was in the States because my older sister lives in Boston. So I was in North America at the time. And I ended up in a room, sharing in this room with three other guys who are all 40, all single, who'd all come up with this. Three of us were Brits. All come up with this idea that we should go to Mexico. Didn't know each other.
That's pretty funny.
Yeah, it was hilarious. And then on the retreat, I had all the benefit of intense meditation giving me clarity. But a key part was that the yoga teacher on that retreat was a lady called Claire Robbie, who's from New Zealand, and she'd given up drinking the year before. And provided a role model for me where I was like, hey, this is a normal kind of person who has chosen not to drink. And I kind of bonded with her over it, and she inspired me to do it. So she didn't say give up forever, but we weren't drinking on the retreat. And then when I got home and I had my first choice, which was, it was a friend's leaving do, and they were moving to a different state. And I was thinking, oh, I can either go to this or I can go to this and drink or not go. And then I had this revelation, which was like, jing, you could go and not drink. I was like, whoa. It was like this truth bomb exploded. And I was like, wow, how have I not thought of that ever before?
That is interesting, because you're probably not alone, that it just doesn't occur to people to go to social settings and just have a drink without alcohol.
Yeah. And, you know, I have got friends who would do it, and, you know, friends who were pregnant who would do it, or friends who would do. I had a friend who did a year off drinking. But for some reason, I never associated that with something that I could do. I thought it was like a weird endurance challenge that they just decided to pick, and they just randomly picked alcohol.
Like training for a marathon or something.
Yeah. And I was like, that doesn't relate to me.
Yeah.
And then had this afternoon out where I went and I had a sparkling water, and I was sociable, and then I didn't have that regret. Like, they all went off. It was an afternoon thing, and then they all went to some house party and I didn't go. And I was like, this is great. I would have completely regretted that thing. And that then took me into, I think it was the 7th of January back in 2018, when I said, right, I'm going to do dry January. And dry January is not a very common thing to do in Australia because it's peak summer summertime.
True.
So in Australia we do dry July is the famous month off.
That makes sense. I wondered why there's a dry July. I just thought it's because they rhyme, but it's probably people in the southern hemisphere, they're like, okay, it's winter now, we'll try it.
Yeah, which is exactly why, like, summer here is December, January, so it's Christmas summer, which is weird because they still have like snow scenes in all the shopping malls, even though it's never snowed here ever at Christmas. But yeah, so I did Dry January and really enjoyed it. And because it was peak summer, I had to go to lots of things that I would never have chosen to in my moderation phase. So I remember there was an Australia Day boat party, which is like the 4th of July. And I had a wedding to go to in New Zealand. And then I pushed it into February and had a ski trip to Japan. So it's like holiday, ski trip. We had a boozy night out in Tokyo where I didn't drink. We did sober karaoke. And I was like, wow, if I can do a wedding, if I can do a holiday, if I can do karaoke, I can do anything.
Yeah.
And I just felt so
enjoy it. I think that's key too. If you're like, wow, I still actually had a good time, but I didn't have to be hungover or say something I regret or, you know,
yeah,
whatever.
So, yeah. So I did. So I definitely still enjoyed it. And especially with the holiday, for example, because our group of friends, like we'd like to ski, but we would, and the ski resort close to Sydney is 6 hours drive away. So we would get on a coach at 4 p.m. on a Friday and just do shots for 6 hours. And then you'd feel
you're hungover the next day.
Yeah. So it would be a ruined weekend of like the skiing would be ruined because we would be all horrendously hungover. So that was a real, real good example for me because I was like, wow, like skiing not hungover is really good. And we're spending all this money going here. So it was going through those events, pushing myself out of my comfort zone, which then said, right, after the 1 month, I'm going to push it to, I said, 100 days. So I got to 100 days and then I had another key moment where I decided to write an article about it. So I, having been a journalist, I was like, I want to write about this. So I wrote an article called What I Learned from 100 Days of Not Drinking, which ended up being a really key moment for me, not because there was anything particularly revelatory in it. Like I just said what I was saying to you then. Oh, it's actually okay. People don't pressure you as much as you think. You know, you wake up without a hangover, isn't it brilliant?
Yeah, you don't become a social pariah.
Yeah. So those things that people find out. So I just wrote what I had experienced, and then the article got quite a lot of attention and 100,000 people read it around Australia, including everyone I knew. So then I became, I came out. Yeah. And I basically put my flag in the ground. Well, I didn't say I'm not going to drink again. I just said, I haven't drunk for 100 days.
Yeah.
But then it became, people would ask me about it. So my friends and colleagues, and it became something I was known for. And the other key thing for me was that I had started teaching meditation. At the end of the article, I said, oh, and by the way, I teach meditation. And I hadn't made a big deal of it in the article, but people were coming to me then because I think I implied, as we'll lead on to, that alcohol's a coping mechanism and I'd found a new coping mechanism. And I was like, well, this is good for business. but having kind of announced it publicly, that was a real benefit to me because this is something I struggle with my clients to talk about and to get them interested in this whole going public thing, because it's a very private thing, but there's so many benefits. So people don't want to announce it publicly because they don't want to fail and they don't want to admit they had a problem to start with or set themselves up for failure.
Yes. I mean, I think like, historically there's been a stigma with saying that you don't drink alcohol, and it's getting better as more and more people like you and Amanda, you and I start talking about it, and all the people who have come before and after us, that stigma is changing. But there has been like, oh, well, I might be embarrassed if people knew I didn't drink.
Yeah. So, which is important for people, like one of the parts of the programs that I lead is we talk about what is your public facing why. You can have your private why and then your public facing why. Well, like, and your public facing why might be the same or you might have different ones tailored to different audiences. And that's what I suggest. And you might have one that you just, what I like with kind of new groups of people, or if you're on a work trip or something, you just say, I don't drink, or I'm not drinking. And people don't question it because they don't know you. They don't want to know.
They really don't that much.
No. And, you know, they don't want to. They don't want to delve into it because you might have all sorts of a crazy story.
Yeah, they don't want to invite an awkward conversation.
Well, no. but this fear of failure thing is, excuse me, it's actually a real benefit. So once you make it part of your public persona in a way that you're comfortable with, and with the public facing wise, I'm like, well, you can make it out as a health thing that you want to do, or you want to call it a challenge. You can say that it's the doctor ordered it. You can say whatever you want, and it doesn't have to start with my name's Rory and I'm an alcoholic. Like that is not necessary. And there's much more of a welcoming environment for it now because of things like Dry January, Dry July, where you can position it I have a client who now describes it as it's a lifestyle change. So it's like saying I've become vegan or something, saying it's a lifestyle change, and I've read about it, and I've read that the benefits are overstated, like all those red wine studies. but then the negatives are enough for me to just choose not to do it without admitting that I'm some degenerate that has a problem, some moral failing. And instead, it's just a choice. I'm choosing not to do this because guess what? You can read 100 articles about how bad it is for you. So I'm choosing not to do it. And I'm not saying, this is the other thing I say is, you just say, I'm pausing. I'm not committing. Like I say, never say forever.
Yeah.
Because it's way too intimidating to think of, well, forever includes every wedding I might ever go to, every holiday I might ever go to, kids' weddings, etc., blah, blah, blah. Too much pressure.
Too much, and too much to commit to, you know?
Yeah. So you say, I'm not drinking. So this is what I say. I'm just not drinking at the moment, or I don't drink. I don't say forevermore, I will not do this.
Yeah.
but by writing this article, it made it part of my public persona, and then that encouraged me to create meditation programs around this idea that it will help you quit drinking. And then once you do this, like with you guys and your podcast, you can't go back. It's not like, oh, should I have a drink now?
It's like, it's probably not
over yet. No, so just create yourself a sober podcast, and then that's your...
That's enough, yeah.
That's your accountability.
And for me, like, I tell people, like, I don't say that I'm never drinking again. Maybe I will. I don't know what the future holds, but I know that right now this is working for me and I feel really good. And I trust that my future self will make the right decision, whatever that happens to be.
Yeah. And you don't have to put the pressure on today's self to figure out what 2028 Jane wants to do.
And I don't want to collect days and years. I don't want to wish my life away. Like, I am enjoying today, this moment right now, and I feel great. And I hope that I don't drink in the future, but you know, who knows? Who knows what's going to happen?
Yeah. I think that will definitely keep people drinking to think too far out. Like if I were to sit here and think, like if I were still actively drinking and I'm thinking about my son going to college and having 4 years in college and I'm, you know, panicking because I'll never, ever be able to have a drink with my son ever. And then I'm thinking all the way forward to like his wedding someday and like the champagne toast. Like I just won't be able to participate in that 10 years from now. And that would probably, you know, keep someone drinking for sure.
And you could just get some non-alcoholic champagne or.
Oh, absolutely.
Maybe he's going to elope and you won't even have a drink at his wedding anyway.
Right. Absolutely. Yeah. Like having, it all comes back to these stories that we're telling ourselves in our head about what might happen. And it usually never happens.
Yeah. And I've found now that like my son's future wedding, I want to be fully present and fully awake to every single moment. And I want to remember everything. And at this point, I wouldn't even want a drink. That would not be a temptation. It would not be a thing I would desire. And so I think people forget that that's also a possibility, that they may not ever want to drink again after they realize what life is really like alcohol free.
Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah.
I am interested, Rory, to hear a little bit more about Vedic meditation.
Yeah, this is my chosen specialist subject, so please cut me off if I drone on.
Well, I'm interested because I've heard of like Vedic, almost like medicine, right? Mm-hmm. But I haven't heard of Vedic meditation, so I'm excited to hear.
Well, yeah, so when I was in that kind of early midlife crisis journey, so I tried out a few different styles of meditation, including mindfulness, which is the most popular type. Mm-hmm. If you use Headspace or Calm, it tends to be mindfulness, which is breath-based.
Yes, usually paying attention to the breath and refocusing the thoughts back onto the breath.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Which tends to be from a Buddhist tradition. So Vedic meditation, as you mentioned, is from the same school as Ayurveda, which is Indian food as medicine tradition. So Vedic meditation is more from, you know, that neither of these things are religious, but it's more from the Hindu tradition, if mm-hmm. mindfulness is from the Buddhist.
Interesting.
And rather than using, so all types of meditation tend to use one of the senses. So breath meditation, you use your feeling sense, so you feel the breath going through your nose or your lungs expanding, etc. Or if you visualize something, you'd be using your sight, even if you're thinking it. In Vedic meditation, we use a mantra. So a mantra is a word or sound that you think silently in your head. So you're not chanting this. You're saying a word in your mind, and that uses your hearing sense. So as a former musician or current musician, it just appealed to me. So as you know, as parents or kids, we're used to having lullabies sung to us. You know, we've all got our Spotify Wrapped to look at the end of the year. Like music is a relaxing, it's a known common relaxing thing.
Absolutely. So for me, and for people to get into spiritual states as well, when you think of almost all forms of worship, there's often a musical component.
Yeah, sound baths and all of that. Mm-hmm. So in my meditation exploration, I stumbled across Vedic and learned from my teacher. So when you learn, you get given a mantra, which you then repeat silently in your head for a 20-minute session. So the mantra is different to breath, because the other thing for me about breath was during my heavy drinking days, I was a smoker. So I was thinking, feel the breath enter your tar-filled lungs.
Probably brings up all sorts of emotions and other thought spirals. And
well, yeah, and then also I in my daily drinking phase I had a couple of panic attacks, and that the breathing part reminded me of the yes. panic attacks. So I'm thinking this is just not my vibe. Yes.
There are some people who you know, with diaphragmatic breathing, that's often encouraged for anxiety. And some people actually have an anxiety response or like a hyper arousal response to deep breathing. So that makes sense.
Well, yeah. And in my worst hangovers in my late 20s, I would get to overthinking things. So, you know, I'd be overthinking all sorts of worst case scenarios, but then including things like, what if I stop breathing? So then I'd have to consciously breathe. And I was like, this is going to be so exhausting to be consciously having to breathe so I don't die. Anyway, so when I learned the mantra technique, I was like, oh, this is great. I'm not using any of this weird apparatus in my chest. Instead, I'm just thinking this word. And what I liked was that as an overthinker, I would normally talk to myself in my head. And this was just replacing that jabber, 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 she said, he said, what's going to happen, with this nice relaxing neutral sound. So I just found that was more relaxing for me. Not to say that mindfulness doesn't work, but for me Vedic worked better. And so, the other
quick question, sorry, the mantra, do they tell you what your mantra is, or do you choose it, or how does that work?
Yeah, so if you do traditional, learn from a Vedic meditation teacher, they pick a mantra for you, and there's a system that they use. They're not using magic. But and as part of that, you go and you witness a ceremony and you bring fruit and flowers, and it's this beautiful thing. When I teach it online, I do a variation of that to keep it pure, keep the tradition pure. I use a universal mantra. So Om is the most famous mantra. I don't use Om, but just to give you an example of what a mantra is.
Okay.
But the Vedic mantras, they tend to not have a meaning, which is important because we're not switching one meaning for another. So Om, for example, one of its meanings is peace. Mm-hmm. So I might be thinking peace, 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 but then I might be thinking war. And then I'm thinking about Gaza. I'm thinking about Ukraine. So we don't want to add more meaning. So it's like it's a neutral sound.
Neutral symbol.
Yeah, which uses the same mechanics like vowels and consonants that I'm used to thinking in. And that brings you to a place of stillness within. The other main difference from mindfulness is that we always have our back supported. So no sitting upright, definitely no lotus position. And at being a bad yogi, that was great for me. So I remember, you know, doing meditation at yoga classes and 2 minutes in going, my back really hurts, I can't do this. And whereas with this, it was more like I was sitting down like I would to watch Netflix or read a book, thinking my nice little lullaby. Yeah, so not with my head rested back, but with my back rested.
Okay.
This kind of middle ground, and that allowed me to enjoy it. And that's the main thing about meditation is if you don't enjoy it, you're not going to do it.
Yeah.
Like, unless you're one of those people who enjoys torturing themselves, and maybe you do like ice baths, and maybe you do want to torture yourself with meditation for 20 minutes in the morning. But I was this kind of lazy Bristol guy, and I just preferred this this easy style. and as I said, like when I learned to do it, it was I could feel my brain relaxing. It was like it had been this clenched fist, and it just started to relax. And I was like, ah, which then has all these benefits, which included being able to say, actually, no, I don't want to have an alcoholic drink on a Wednesday. But also included, no, I don't want to worry about what's going to happen in that meeting tomorrow. I'm just going to turn up and trust that the me on the day will be able to figure it out, and I'm not going to be able to figure out every particular scenario. So less worrying about work, less worrying about how I appeared in social situations. And that was that whole realization that I had been stressed before. And then you get into the whole thing of people who drink to manage stress, which is so interesting because it was and there's that famous Huberman Lab podcast on alcohol where he talks some more about the actual mechanics of it and how it spikes cortisol. So cortisol is one of the main stress hormones, and there's studies that show it makes your stress hormones higher. Mm-hmm. It's such a bad quick fix. One way I was thinking of describing it yesterday was, I posted on Instagram actually. It was drinking to manage your stress is like getting out another credit card to manage your finances.
That's really good. You're borrowing like, it, but you are going to pay it back with some interest later.
Yeah. So it works, right? But yes. It's not good, and no, you wouldn't recommend it to anyone you know as a strategy.
Yeah, and not only does it increase stress hormones, but once those feel-good neurotransmitters are artificially elevated from alcohol, then your brain's attempt to reach homeostasis, then the next day they're much lower than they would be at baseline. And so you feel worse.
Yeah, and then you're in the addictive cycle because you have more, and it doesn't have to be every day, but you have more reason to do it because you're feeling worse than before.
You want to reach your baseline and feel normal again.
Yeah, and that's the whole, you know, just the extreme being that the kind of daily heroin addict thing where they have to take it to feel normal.
Yes,
and it's the this crazy thing where you're even heavy, you know, heavy drinkers, it's drink to feel normal, which I, you know, on a hangover, that's the hair of the dog. I have to feel normal. Absolutely. And it's getting another way of feeling normal and feeling happy and having that balance of chemicals. So this is why I use, I promote meditation as a tool to help people. It's like, look, if you're feeling down, if you're feeling stressed, or if you're feeling, you know, frazzled, meditate first and then see how you feel. So I'd say, look, it's a wellness strategy. You may not think that drinking is a wellness strategy, but you are using it as one, especially if you're a 5 p.m., 6 p.m., I've had a stressful day at work drinker. You're using it as a wellness strategy.
Yeah, so let's steam or let loose or whatever the case may be.
Yeah, or, you know, there's lots of reasons, but or it's my reward because my day's been really hard. So I say, well, look, at 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, meditate first and then see if you still feel like that. And, you know, there are other ways to deal with it, because you can do exercise and you can eat some food and all those other things to manage triggers. But the thing that I particularly am an advocate of is meditation, because that was my experience of when I learned to do this. I just felt more comfortable, less needy. And that's for, you know, my neediness was expressed in alcohol, but it's any kind of other neediness, like scrolling on social media or doom scrolling the news. It's like you need something, or someone was talking about counter surfing where they come home and they just eat all the snacks off the counter.
Yeah.
And it's like or binge watch, you know, scary TV shows.
Yeah.
So you're going to be
on the
less
Amazon app and put some things in your cart and
yeah,
they're there in 2 days, you know.
Yeah. Well, I used to be, you can see the books in the background. I used to be a huge book buyer at uni. And what I love about being a Kindle person now is I just get the sample and that ticks my box of, all right, I've got it.
Yeah.
It didn't cost me any money.
Forget about it.
No. And I'll never, you know, it doesn't matter if I never read it because I've not paid $15 for it.
Exactly. It's not taking up actual space in your home.
Well, yeah, now I buy the books after I've read them. When I like them, I buy it as a memento.
I like it. So I'm curious, in that journey, I think you mentioned finding meditation. Was that when you were having your second 20s in Sydney, around 35?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah, yeah. So it was
before
it was
30, maybe around 35, right?
Yeah, so I was 35 when I quit smoking and DJing, and then I was 36. Towards the end of 36, when I learned to meditate.
So, and then, how did you stumble upon meditation?
So, I had so I did my exercise thing, and it's common for people to get into their marathon journey in their mid 30s. Mm-hmm. So I was in that, and the main thing was I had a mentor at work. I was just given this awesome mentor who noticed all these changes I was making. I loved all the personality tests that we got given at work. Like, we did Myers-Briggs that lots of people do, and then we did this other one called the Enneagram. Mm-hmm. And I was
so
loving
what are
this.
Yours?
Kind
Hold on. I love both of these. What's your Myers-Briggs?
Myers-Briggs. So it was always ENTP. So for those who, I'm sure most people know this, but E is extrovert, introvert. Mm-hmm. And I was actually, I've become an I, or I've come into my natural I-ness, introvertness.
Yes, you've answered the questions truthfully, and it's
yeah,
that you're an introvert.
Well, because in the introvert extrovert questions in Myers-Briggs, they're about how you present or how you
yes.
interact in the world, and they're like, do you find it okay to be in groups of people at parties and blah blah blah, like. Which, as a drinker, I was like, yeah, tick, tick,
like,
tick.
I
I'm all of those
it.
Things.
I do it all the time.
Whereas now, as a no longer drinker, I'm like, well, no, I prefer to stay home. And
yes.
No,
I enjoy it, but then I need a break and I need to relax a little bit.
Yeah. And then even in the drinker days, I was only just an extrovert, like a 52% kind of thing.
Yes. I'm so an I too. I'm an INFJ.
Okay.
And then my Enneagram is a 5.
So 5 is the...
The observer, the investigator.
Yes. Okay.
What about you?
My Enneagram was 3, which is the achiever.
Yes.
So the achiever needs kind of external validation and likes to get good marks, etc. And yes. I did a video about this the other day. Like I applied, so my achiever personality was great because it meant I got good grades at school and got a master's degree even while drinking heavily. Mm-hmm. But then what I realized is that I'd also applied my achiever mentality to drinking. So I was like, I can be last man standing or I can be the best party monster.
Mm-hmm. And still get your master's while doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Work hard, play hard, that whole thing.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, all of those personality things, there are extremes. And I especially like the Enneagram because they go through the whole spectrum of what a yeah. high functioning 3. So a high functioning 3
the
is like
healthy versus the stressed 3.
Yeah, so I can't remember exactly what they are, but like a healthy 3 is doing lots of the public and out there and getting acclaim, but for good works.
Yes,
and I love it on that scale, like the unhealthy version of them. They're all like a jealous murderer. Or like suicide.
Yeah.
And you're like, wow, they didn't right. tone that in. They just it's the full spectrum.
Yes. I saw an Enneagram quote the other day that said that the Enneagram is not to put you in a box. It's to help you identify the box you're in so you can get out of it. And I thought that was pretty good.
Yeah, I love that. And that's what I didn't like about Myers-Briggs and what I preferred about things like NLP. There's a thing called metaprograms in NLP where it's like, here's a spectrum of introvert to extrovert or black and white thinking to nuanced thinking or yes. big picture to detail. And you can notice where you are on that and notice if it's useful for you to be where you are on that state, on that yeah. scale. So going back to your question, those kind of investigations from and me loving finding out about this stuff prompted the mentor to say, hey, you should try meditation. I was like, oh, yeah, why not? But I'd actually been put off because in my first job 10 years before that, we'd had the boss who was this idiot guy used to run.
Hopefully he's run not a listening.
No. Oh, well, hi, Sam, if you are. he would run these meditation things, but he wouldn't give us any instruction. He would just say, right, come on, everyone, we're going to close our eyes and meditate. And he was this, he ran this magazine, which is like this progressive left-wing magazine. So he was into all that kind of stuff. But then he also ripped off all the clients, and what else? It took tax out of our wages and kept it. Like all these, like I won't name him. So he won't sue me.
Not very social justice oriented.
Well, no. So that had all wrapped up meditation with this bad vibe for me.
Yeah.
As well as the fact there wasn't any instruction. So I was like, oh, I'm supposed to clear my mind. Probably. I can't clear my mind. This is horrible. This
I'm
is
a
awful.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, so that put me off for 10 years until I was like, right, I'm going to have another go. So he suggested it, my mentor, and then I tried out a few of these styles, and I got benefit from all of them in terms of I was feeling more present, I was feeling less stress, even though I probably wouldn't have called it stress. I just felt more comfortable in my skin was how I called it. Mm-hmm. And then once I'd found Vedic, I used to write regularly write my journal then, and I even like 2 weeks in I was like, I'm gonna teach this is amazing, I love this stuff.
It got you excited.
It did, and it was just like, wow. And usually it's just a very kind of mundane thing that makes you feel a bit better, but in the early days I had a few quite vivid experiences where like very visual things or kind of quite trippy things. which I don't often talk about because it makes people think that, you know, they're supposed to be having some LSD experience.
Yeah, or something's wrong, like they don't, or...
Yeah, like I had a conversation with someone yesterday and they're like, you know, and I was just saying, look, it's not ayahuasca. It's not some hallucinogen. Like, people can have experiences, but mostly it is I sit down, I'm a bit stressed, I'm a bit tired, I'm a bit frazzled. And then they come out feeling I'm less tired, I'm less frazzled, I'm less needy.
Yes, I feel centered put my phone and grounded.
Down. I'm more likely to go for a run. I'm less likely to want to binge something.
Yes, or yell at my kids or whatever.
Well, yeah. So once I'd found the meditation, I was just super keen, and I applied my achiever mentality to being a consistent meditator. And then, yeah, that next couple of years was me changing my identity away from party monster, because once I'd given that up, there was a bit of a hole.
Yeah.
And like, if you'd asked me, I wouldn't have been able to say it, but if you'd asked me what my meaning was in my 20s, I might have said something like, it's helping people forget their worries on the dance floor. And it's like, yay, we've had a shit week, party on.
Go have fun.
Yeah. And then thinking about, well, how am I going to replace that kind of role that I was playing? And then realizing over time that in my 40s, it could be helping people overcome their worries through meditation. And it's the same kind of core desire to about how I interact with the world, but in a much more healthy, appropriate way for my age.
Benefits your brain rather than harms it.
Yeah. And you know, it was more appropriate to where I was. So once I'd kind of had the idea that I could maybe teach this, then it gave more meaning to my life. And then the next few years were transition. So I was still, until I met Claire on that retreat, I didn't have an idea that people did this, people gave up. Because mm-hmm. this was six years ago now. And then also figuring out that I wanted to teach meditation as my main thing. So having this kind of transition thing, which led into my 40s, and then now being 46, being like, okay, well, this is great. I've got a meaningful thing that I enjoy doing. I have a way of interacting with the world, and getting to run retreats in Bali as you are, and doing these things and watching people transform and just being able to be of service, is a very happy place for me right now.
For sure. So tell us a little bit about leading retreats. Is this something you've done for a while, or is Bali one of the first that you will do?
Yeah, so Bali's the first one that I'm running. I've been on lots of retreats, but I've been such a scaredy cat in terms of putting one on, because they're like a big pressure thing. So we were talking about Alex McRobert, Sober Yoga Girl, before.
Yes.
I had known through being on podcasts and being in the scene, if you will.
Yeah.
And then I had this, if I quit drinking during my earlier midlife crisis, I had my real midlife crisis last year, and I ended up living in Bali for 2 months. And I remembered that Alex was there. So I just messaged her on Instagram, and we went for lunch and we became friends. And she actually suggested that we do a retreat together. And I was like, brilliant, because Alex has done, I don't know, 30, 40 retreats.
She's done a lot.
And I was like, okay, well, this is great. This is going to be the confidence booster I need. So we decided to do it. And then we got on our scooters and we rode around looking at a few places. And then we just picked one because we just fell in love with it. And yeah, just really looking forward to, yeah, one, doing my first retreat, to it being in Bali. Like, so Bali's very close to Australia. Mm-hmm. It's, well, when I say very close, it's a 6-hour flight, but from the States, it's a long way.
It's a long, long way. Other side of the globe.
but looking forward to doing that one with Alex and having these two vibes. So she's obviously Sober Yoga Girl. Like, I don't call myself this, but I'm kind of sober meditation guy.
Yeah.
So I think it'll be a really good
And so I guess it will be for men and women who are, is it for people who are alcohol free or maybe considering that and also are interested in meditation?
Yeah. So, I mean, it's for people who are interested in what yoga and meditation can do. I'm presenting it as it can be the beginning of your sober journey, or it can be, so it can kickstart it or it can supercharge it if you're later on. Mm-hmm. Actually, probably half the people who've signed up so far are already alcohol free. So they're kind of using it as a supercharge version. But yeah, open to everyone, and yeah, we'll see what me and Alex will create in this combo. But I think it's going to be great.
Yeah, that's awesome. Well, how absolutely can our listeners find you if they want to get in touch with you or find out more information?
Yes, so the website that I use for all of this is called Wise Monkey Way, and we've been talking about how meditation can help, and this is how I've personified it. It's like you've got the wine monkey in you, which is saying, hey, wouldn't a glass of wine be good right now? And then you have the wise monkey, which is saying, hey, wouldn't it be good to go for a run and, you know, meditate and work on your business idea? So it's called Wise Monkey Way, wisemonkeyway.com, and this idea that there is a wise version of you which you can empower through things like meditation. So you can feed this wise monkey, or you can do it through exercise or through diet choices and yoga. And this is what we do in my approach, is we say we're going to put all these good things in. We're going to forgive you for the slip-ups you have. We're going to add in community to you know, make you feel that you're not out on your own doing this. There are people going through exactly the same problems as you. So if people go to wisemonkeyway.com, they'll find I do a 30-day meditation-based program. I do one-on-one coaching, and then I've got the Bali retreat. So please sign up to all of them and bring your friends.
That's awesome.
And there's also a free, I call it my 11-minute stress-busting meditation. So it's where you you can switch wine o'clock for meditation o'clock, and this idea of that 5 p.m., 6 p.m., break where you need this, you need a transitional tool. Nice. So you can come and grab that for free. That's wisemonkeyway.com/stress, or it's in the header if you find it.
That's great, because I think so much of the cocktail that people have after a long day of work, it's almost like this conditioned response that they pair this alcohol with feeling relaxed because their work is over and their day is done. But if we pair it with something like meditation, we can get a very similar response and then continue on with a productive rest of our day and not feel bad the next day.
Exactly. 100%. And that's the way in for people. I'm like, you don't have to think about, you know, your identity or what your public facing why is or any of those things until later. Yeah. Just sort out your coping mechanism first. And this is the other thing I say to people, look, sitting down at the end of the day and putting your feet up is relaxing anyway, yeah. Right? You've just associated it with drinking, like you've associated sitting by the pool with having like a pina colada, yes. But sitting by the pool is relaxing anyway.
Exactly. You know, like that's the least time you would need an alcoholic beverage. Yeah, you don't need... You relax, you're by the pool and you're not working and, you know.
Yeah. So. But yeah, I find that the early evening meditation is a real like extra additional thing, rather than just saying, look, you can just remove the drink. It's like, well, look, we're going to give you this well tried and tested technique. I mean, there are thousands of studies about how it helps with things like stress and how it helps with things like sleep and how it helps all sorts of medical conditions. Mm-hmm. So just replace this as your wellness technique. Then you're not getting out your new credit card to manage stress. And you're being a good little saver, you're paying into your Wise Monkey account.
Yes.
And then things become a lot easier, and also you become more forgiving of yourself, because on most alcohol-free journeys there are blips, right? There are setbacks, and if you've got this resilience and forgiving mindset that naturally gets developed through meditation, you're more likely to be able to ride through those. Mm-hmm. and not take it as a success failure. You know, me with my achiever thing, I was like, oh no, there's failure there. I don't want to avoid that.
Yeah, it's all or nothing. If you're not perfect, then it's a failure.
Yeah, and so many people have that perfectionism trait. And it's like, all right, well, it will help with that because it's balancing. It's putting you as the healthy version of whatever your personality is. And that person is going to be less likely to need to drink.
Absolutely. That's awesome. What a genius program you've developed. I love it.
Yeah. Well, thank you. It's something that it came so organically for me to be doing this, and yeah, I'm so happy that I'm doing this and not reviewing vodka festivals in New Zealand anymore.
Yes, exactly. Well, last question. Anyone who's considering this, any advice you would give or any encouragement or any just little tips that you wish someone would have said to you years ago in your second 20s?
Yeah, well, I would just say to try it, right? And give yourself a solid month to do it. And experience life. Trust yourself that you're going to be able to enjoy these things. And I was really lucky to have all those things in my first week, like the wedding, like the skiing holiday, because what I didn't have in my moderation phase is that those events were the ones that I would drink at, and I would just not go out the rest of the time. But it was going through those things. So if you're in that moderation phase where you're sometimes drinking, sometimes not, have the trust in yourself to do one of those big events not drinking, because it's really by doing those ones that you go, oh, hang on, that was fine. You know, people don't notice what you're drinking, and then you notice that they're super drunk and you don't want to be like that.
Right. You have this emotionally corrective experience of like, oh, it's not actually what I thought it was going to be.
Yeah. And you can read all the Quitlet you like, but you won't get that until you go through it yourself. So I would say find a coping mechanism, which might be yoga, which might be meditation, which might be some kind of exercise. Replace that and then start experiencing life. And it doesn't have to mean go to the bar at 2 a.m., but get out and interact with people.
Yes, don't isolate socially. We need people. Even us introverts need people.
Yeah, and that might mean saying, hey, friend who I normally have Friday night wines with, come for a coffee on Sunday morning. Like keep that connection, but rejig it so it's not you being in this, you know, you being in the club at 4 a.m. with your water. You're having a coffee walk on the Sunday morning, which is much more normal not to be drinking. So you're less of that pressure thing, but you want that connection because isolation is a key driver of people drinking as well. So, you know. Yeah, and join a community. So there are so many sober communities out there of like-minded people. Absolutely. Join one of them, and then you'll notice that then you get these role models, that which is so key for me, having Claire as a role model. It's like, oh, this is a kind of relatable person.
Yes.
Not, you know, not Robert Downey Jr. pictured in cuffs going to his rehab, right? But someone who's like you.
Awesome. Well, thank you again for joining us today. It's just been a pleasure getting to know you and getting to hear a little bit about your story and what you're doing.
Yeah, great, Jane. Amanda, thanks so much for having me.
Thank you so much for listening. We truly value each one of you. In support of the podcast, please follow or subscribe to the Mindful Sobriety Podcast.
We'd love to connect with you via Instagram at Jane W. Ballard and or DFW Yoga Girl. Sending you love and light.